in a simple program that we went through yesterday, I introduced two new methods, the get method and the put method, whose job is to simply get a character from CN without converting it, one character, including white space or any other characters that might be in the file, and putC, which given a character, sends it to cout. These are both methods that are defined for the cin and cout streams, and we can simply use this. In this case, this program, you remember, simply copied whatever I typed, character for character, it sent it to the screen. Now, we'd like to extend this program and have it not read character by character from the keyboard, but read character from character from a file. And instead of sending the results to the screen, as this one does, send it to a new file. In essence, what I'm describing is a little program that copies files. If it goes into any file and takes out each byte, the character's a byte, without paying attention to what that byte represents, because it simply takes a character or a byte at a time. You can use the word byte and character interchangeable. So you could take a single byte or character from a given file, send it to a new file. So what you're doing is copying. It's just like the copy command in Windows, which is, by the way they wrote it. So what we're seeing now is, for the first time, we're going to see how they write their own routines, and we'll be writing a very simple program to do that. So if you look at your handouts, we're going to look at copy file 2. Let me close this one. Now, I need to have something to copy. So what I did was, I created for us, and we're going to use this particular file over and over again. So I gave it to you, a copy of it in your notes. I have a file that I created called originalfile.txt, which contains the Gettysburg address. Where are you? There it is. The text file, just like any other file that you've created in the past using the notepad. And you'll notice it has some blank lines in it, and it's got punctuation marks. It's just text for our purpose. Now, just to show that I'm not cheating, the last time I ran this program, I'm going to get rid of the results. This was the last time, so I'm going to get rid of delete copiedfile.txt, so it doesn't exist. Now, the idea is, simply, let me just run it. The idea is for it to appear to do nothing, because we're not taking anything from the keyboard, nor are we sending anything to the screen. What it did was, it went ahead and it took the original file that you have a copy of and made a copy of it somewhere, right there, with today's date on it, so I didn't cheat. And this file, let's look at it, is identical in every respect to the copied file, to the original file. Okay? So how does this work? It works almost identically to the one that you've just seen. The only difference is that we include file stream, because we're processing files. You've done that before. I use the declaration, the one-line format of the declaration. I say, if ifstream, which is input file stream, quote in file, you can quote anything you want, original file.txt. OF stream or output file stream, call it out file, which is copied file.txt, the one I want to create. And as usual, it is a very important concept to get used to the idea. Not all of you are doing this. Each and every file that you use in your program should be verified after it's open. Okay, check. If not in file is open, print a message unable to open the input file. Maybe you forgot to give it an input file. If not out file is open, print a message. Those are, again, maybe there's no room on the disk to create the new file. So it's very important, part of our idea of robust programming, to try to think ahead what could go wrong and account for it within our program. Once you've done that, the bulk of the program is almost identical, if not identical, to what we just did before. I say while not in file.eof, c=infile.get, the get method, and outfile.putc. So we get a character from the original file, we put it into C, and we then send it to the output file. Over and over and over again until there are no characters left. Remember again, the while not infile.eof, that's our idiom, our way of saying process the file one byte or one character at a time until there's nothing left. And that's the whole difference if you compare program 1 with program 2, the two versions. One used C in and C out, which went to the keyboard and went to the screen. And this one uses any file you choose. So it does exactly the same. Are there any questions about how this program works? I guess that's no. Or that I'm still asleep, I haven't had my coffee this morning, or I have no idea what's flying. This is your chance. If you have any questions, ask. Okay, so let's move on. Last time, I talked about the importance of writing functions. What I'm going to do today is to show you a rather large program and ask you if you would have had to write this program without using functions, how complicated it might be. And what we'll do is we'll develop this program from the beginning, but using functions will make the job, even though it's a very complicated job, rather easy to do. We're going to get back to character processing after this, shortly. So let's get back now, put our function cap on. What I want to do is I want to write a program to play the simple game called head or tails. Now, are you all familiar with the game of head or tails? I pull a coin out of my pocket, I flip it, I ask you to call it, you say either heads or tails, and then I look at the coin, compare it to what you said. If you got it right, you get a point. If you get it wrong, you don't get a point. We decide we want to play this game for 10 games, and we see at the end of 10 games whether or not you've gotten it more right or more wrong. Now, we want this to be an honest game. Okay, I don't want to cheat. I could, of course, in the real world, use a coin that's not evenly balanced, but or I could, in the computer, tell the computer to cheat and peek at what you've called before it actually compares to see whether it flipped that way, and the computer can win at all times. But we want an honest game. Okay? Now, let's just talk about statistics for a moment. If I have 100% an honest coin, what does that mean in terms of what I expect when I flip it? 50% heads and 50% tails. Now, does that mean that if you flip it 10 times, you expect to get 5 heads and 5 tails? Not at all. In fact, it would not violate what you've just told me if I got 9 tails and 1 head. But if I flipped it 50,000 times, would you expect it to be closer to 50-50? In other words, statistics, the more times you flip it, okay, the more accurate your statistics are. Okay, if I just flip a coin 10 times, there's no reason to expect exactly half and half. But in the limit, as n goes to infinity, n being the number of flips, then the number of flips you would get would be 50 heads and 50% tails. Is that pretty reasonable? Okay. Now if I ask you, if that was the whole instructions I gave you, write a program to implement the game of heads or tails, more than likely you would not know where to begin. For that matter, neither would I. Okay? But like a lot of things in life, when you are faced with a task, you postpone as much as you can to later on. Okay? It's like writing programs. You wait to the very last possible moment. Well, in our design of programs, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to start writing a main program and keep on pushing off the things that we don't know how to do until we get them simpler and simpler and simpler until we eventually figure out how to do each piece. And that's basically a divide and conquer. Okay? If you have to clean your house, and you walk in the house and you just don't even know where to begin. So you say, you know what, I'm going to do one room at a time. Then you go into your teenager's room and you decide, there's no way I can clean this. So you say, okay, I'm going to do the dusting today, and the clothing to clean the clothing tomorrow, and the organizing things on the shelves another day. Each job can be specified in terms of simpler and smaller jobs. And when you get down to those simple jobs, they're easy to do. Okay? So we'll do the same thing here. And you have this program, and it's on several pages, but we're going to look at it piece at a time, and you'll see that it's actually quite easy to understand how to do this once you're finished. And I believe it is called Heads or Tails. Let me run the game first, to give you some idea of how I want this to turn out. So I'm going to run the game. And the first thing I do is want to give you a set of instructions. Everyone have that in the handout, so at least you have it where... Now don't look at the code right now, let's just look at the game. So I run it, I want it to give some instructions. That's always useful when you start a program, to tell the person who's playing the game what the rules of the game are. So this is the game of Heads or Tails. It will flip a coin, you call it. If you call it correctly, you win, otherwise I win. To call heads, type 0. To call tails, type 1. As I toss my coin, I will tell you to call it. Okay, the first thing the computer wants to know is how many games you want to play. So I'll say 5 games instead of 10 games, so we don't spend the rest of the day playing games. So I'll say 5 games. So it says call it. Okay, each of you get a chance. Heads or tails? Okay. What did I say? Heads was 1, tails was 1, heads was 0. Okay, so you say heads. Okay. I have tails, you lose. That is a 1. A 1, right. Okay, you have tails, you win. Can't say 3. It's heads or tails. In fact, if you say 3, error. Type 0 for heads and 1 for... See, he tried to cheat. And we built this in as a robust game. It's either heads or tails, 0 or 1, you can't type in 3. So which do you want? You can't say 2. Because the rules of the game is a coin has only 2 sides, a head or a tails. So either a tails, either you're going to... You know the game Heads or Tails, have you played it? So you have to say either heads or tails, one or the other. You can't say the side, coins don't land on the side. So you choose a heads or a tails. Tails, okay. So tails we said was putting in a 1. Okay. I have heads, you lose. Heads. 0. I have heads, you win. Huh? Tails. That was a 1. And I'm sorry you don't get to play. Because we only said 5 games. I should have counted the people that are in the room. And therefore, final report. You won 3 games, you lost 2 games, total number of games is 5. So, the class wins. Okay. Now, what I want to do is to write the program to do that. It's a rather complicated program, if you think about it. When do you start? So, let's not look at the declarations. We always can put them in after the fact. We start with the main. The main is going to be very simple. It's going to first print a bunch of instructions. Remember I told you, when you write functions, have the main do as little as work as possible. Push everything off. So step number 1, print instructions. We'll deal with the details of what print instructions is later on. Then we're going to say, how many times do you want to play? And you supplied me, or I supplied the number 5. And then, what did I want to do? Play the game 5 times. So therefore, my function, my main, has a function called print instructions, which is responsible for printing the instructions. Does it have any input? Does print instructions be given anything? No. So its function prototype has void. And does the print instructions return anything when it's done? Also not, right? It simply prints the instruction and that's it. So its return type is void as well. Print the instructions. Print out a message, get the number you type in, and then we send it to a function called play, which obviously is responsible for playing the game, and we tell it we want you to play it n, or 5 times in this case. So what is the input for play? An integer, the number you supply. Therefore, its function prototype is play is int. A play, when it comes back, it's all over. It's finished. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't give me back a number. The game is over. So therefore, its return type is also going to be void. Okay? Does everyone understand the basic structure, the basic outline of our program at this point? Yeah, we have no idea how to play the game yet. But the game, we break it down into printing instructions, playing a game. Okay? Simple? Okay. So first we're going to look at print instructions. That's pretty easy. And there it is. It prints instructions for the user. Remember I told you that every function should begin with a comment, no more than one line, that in one sentence says what this function does. And clearly what this function does is prints instructions for the user. It's void print instructions. And it consists of a single statement, see out, this is the game of heads or tails, etc., etc., etc. Now, just some comments on style. Let me run the game again and compare how I wrote this to what runs. All I want you to do is to look at this part over here. Okay? Notice that I broke up, since this is a very big statement, printing out lots of lines, I broke it up in my program, just for convenience, line by line as I wanted it to be printed, so when you read the program, you can see how the instructions are going to look without having to run the program. Notice that there is a line, 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 just like, and I just made one see out statement, indented it nicely. The see out statement ends here, there's the semicolon. But I did it this way rather than just run it through one big long line or make multiple see outs, just so that it should look like this, to make it easy for me, the reader of the program, to understand what's going on. Now, there's something here that I think you may not have seen before. Notice that several places here I want to print out single quotes, for example. See? Now, if I was to simply put a single quote inside of a see out statement, the computer would be confused. Why? Because we know what single quotes are meant for. They're meant to surround chars. But I don't mean them here to be those type of single quotes. I mean them to be the single quotes that I want to be printed. In the same way, suppose you wanted to print a double quote. How could you print a double quote if every time the computer sees a double quote, it's going to look for another double quote and say that's a string? It's going to use the double quotes to show beginning and end rather than as something that's supposed to be printed. In order to indicate that I want to print a single quote, or a double quote for that matter, I put in front of it what we call our escape character. Just as this slash told you that this N is not the letter N, rather it should be used as a new line, and the slash T means that it's not the letter T, but rather it's the tab. In the same way, the slash single quote and the slash single quote here mean that the single quote is meant to be actually printed and not to be the single quote that we normally put around characters. And similarly, if we wanted a double quote, we would say slash double quote, it would then print the double quote rather than assuming it's the double quote that goes in the beginning and the end of a string. Any questions about that? So we have our very simple print instruction function, which was over here. So that's what this line did. Then, I'm sorry, that's what this line did. Then we printed out, how many times do you want to play? How many times do you want to play? And I do a C in N, so we put in some number, I want to play the game 2 times. Okay? That's this. And now I'm going to call the play. That's where all the action occurs. Okay? So now we need to look at play. Again, a lot of things I still don't know about how to implement the game yet. So we're going to break it down into pieces. Again, let's for a moment ignore the declarations. We'll get back to them later. The purpose of this function is to Function play actually plays the game. The computer does the tossing. The user, that should say, does the calling. Okay. Now, let's think for a moment. If I want to play the game five times, each game is exactly the same. If I want to play it 10 times, each game is exactly the same. In other words, what I want to do is I want to have a loop that repeats the instructions for playing a single game 10 times. When you told me play it 5 times, I want to have a big loop that says play the game 5 times. If you told me 2, play the game 2 times. So the program itself simply consists of a loop that starts here for I equals 0, I less than N, plus plus I, and the game ends over here. So this lines up. What you see in this loop is simply what a single game is. Right? Does that make sense? So if I figure out how to play a single game, I put it in a loop, it'll play it over as many times as I want to play it. Is that clear? Now, the idea was that we play the game 5 times, and then we produce the summary, the results. Right? You saw who won, who lost at the end. So that's what we have here. We play the game, that's this piece, as many times as you want, and when it's finished, we simply print the final report. We have to tell that function how many times the person won, how many times the person lost, and how many games were played altogether, so we can print out the nice report at the end. We'll get to the details of that later on. Again, I'm postponing this until later. So what I really need to look at, I can now ignore this, and I can ignore this. The bulk of the work is this. Okay, that defines a single game. Does that make sense? So what is a single game? Remember we played a single game? First the computer printed a message saying, call it. Then you put in a number 1 or 0, so we have to get that number. Meanwhile, we have to have the computer somehow or other flip a coin. We'll talk about that later on. Once the computer flips a coin, we have to be able to compare the two of them. If they match, we add 1 to the win counter and say, hey, you won. If they lost, if they don't match, we add 1 to the lose counter and say a message, you lost. And then we do the whole thing all over again. So let's look at what it is. First, I print out a message, call it. Then, the computer, behind the scenes, tosses the coin. I have no idea how this happens right now. Okay? So I call a little function called toss. I'll put off the details to later. How to implement toss, which is the hard part here, we will push off until later on. So let's assume the computer figures out somehow or other how to toss a coin, and it does it, and of course it now knows whether the coin is heads or tails. So the next thing we're going to do is we're going to get the call from the user. We're going to get the number that you've put in, either 0 or 1, and we're going to compare it with the coin. If they match, if get call from user, which again, I didn't implement the details, but if get call from user is a number, it is equal to coin, which is what the computer tossed, then I will say plus plus win, and I will report that you've won. If they don't match, then I will report that you've lost. Make sense? Now, there are 2 ways you could win, aren't there? You could have tossed the heads. I mean, the computer could have tossed the heads, and you could have called the heads, so you would win. Or you could have called the tails, and the computer could have tossed the tails, and you would win. And I'd like it to print that message. I want it to print the message: you tossed a heads, you won, or you tossed a tails, you won. So the function report a win has to know whether you won by tossing a heads or whether you won by calling a tails. Similarly, if you lost, if you're down here, if they don't match, You could have lost, why? Because you called heads, but really was a tails. Or you called tails, and it really was a head. And I want the message to be the right message. So in both cases, notice that when I call the function, report a win, or report a loss, I'm also sending it the coin, in other words, the identity, heads or tails, so that it'll be able to print the message, you won because you called the heads, or you won because you called the tails. Okay? So that's why I'm sending the function, report a win and report a loss, the identity of the coin that was tossed. Okay. So, this is simple. Okay? See out, say call it. Now comes the hard part. I have to toss the coin. I have to have some function whose job it is to do what? What do you think this function is going to have to do? How can we simulate there's not a little penny inside the computer that's being flipped? What does it really mean that we need to do at this point? How would you simulate the toss of a coin? You would choose what at random? One or zero. Exactly. If you choose one or zero at random, and assuming that it is truly random, because it's an honest coin, then you will have been simulating a flipped coin. So toss has to somehow or other do what you just said, precisely what you said. Choose a number, zero or one, at random. Now, before we go into talking about this, how we do this, let's talk the mathematics of random numbers a little bit. What does it mean for a number to be truly random? What does it mean if I flip a coin, take a coin? What does it mean, an honest coin? There's no bias, okay? What does that mean? Good. And mathematically, what does that mean? It means two things. Number one, there can be no way for him to predict ahead of time what number you choose from 0 to 1. Because if he could predict it, then it's not really random. So number one, there can be no way of knowing what that result is going to be. And the second, does a random tell you whether it's going to be heads or tails? No, it tells you that the results will follow the statistics that you want to expect for random numbers. Okay? In the case of a coin, what are the statistics for random numbers? That if we flip the coin sufficiently large number of times, we will expect to find roughly 50 heads and 50 tails. 50% heads, 50% tails. Or putting it more precisely, mathematically one would say that if n represents the number of flips, okay, as n goes to infinity, another way of saying that in the limit, as n goes to infinity, if you took calculus course, okay, you then expect to find 50% heads and 50% tails. Another way of putting this, since mathematically 50% is what? We don't use percent, we use 0.5. So 0.5 heads, 0.5 tails, and of course, the has to add up to 1, which means all possible coins. None of them had to fall out, roll away, they could find out what the pennies were. Okay? So what happens if we, supposedly we had a dice, okay? And it was an honest, not a loaded dice, okay? And you won dice, and you toss the dice. What would one expect the truly random, honest dice to have? Each number would have a possibility, since there are 6 sides to the dice, so therefore there would be 1/6, okay, of a chance for each one, and therefore 1/6 plus 1/6 plus 1/6, the 6 of them, adds up to 1, because that's what the statistics have to be. Okay? People talk about curves for tests, right? So we say the average. The class took a test and got an average. Does the average mean anything? There are 6 people sitting in this room right now. Does a class average on the test mean something? No. Why? Because it could be that this particular class is a particularly smart class. And maybe everybody in the class gets very high grades, and one person got a low grade. Or it could mean that it's a particularly dumb class, and everybody got very low grades. So the average, and one person got a very high grade, which would balance out all the low grades. So the average means nothing. But if I had 1,000 students, then you would expect, if it's a good test, most of the students to get around the average, which would, let's say, be a C if it would be a fair test. A little bit more students would get B's and D's, and fewer still would get A's and F's. And what we're describing is what's called the normal curve, which basically says this is what the average should be, okay? And most of the students fall between here and here. That's your C grades. Then you have some percentage of students getting B's and some getting D's. So this is your C's, this is your B's, this is your D's. And some smaller number of students get A's and F's. That's called the bell curve. And this is when you ask a teacher to curve the test. What it really means is that if the average was not, let's say, what it should have been, let's say the average was, it means shift the grades so that the average falls right over here. But that only makes sense, statistically anyway, if the teacher has a lot of mercy on you, they may curve the test like I do, and end up giving you some extra points just because I'm a nice guy. But if it's a statistical application, to make it fair, I would have to have 1,000 or more students, many, many students in the class, so that I'm pretty sure that in an average class of thousands of students, there are some very smart students, some very dumb students, but most of the students are average, which is what the word average means. Okay? Make sense? Okay. So talking now about random numbers. Suppose, we just talked about what it meant to flip a coin randomly. One is we can't predict whether the next coin is going to be heads or tails. Have to have no way of predicting it. And B, as I flip it many, 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 many times, I have to get 50% heads and 50% tails. In the case of a die, again, what does it mean to have an honest die? One is that if I flip the die, you have no way of predicting what if the next number is going to be. And number two, if I flip the die thousands and thousands of times, I would expect that each face would come up 1/6 of the time. Okay? What does it now extension mean to choose a number at random? Any number at random. Choosing any number at random is essentially like saying I have a huge class of 1,000 students, and the grades they get on, none of them studied. So each of them chooses a number from 1 to 100, which is going to be their midterm grade. And, well, that's obviously they're all going to choose 100. So let's take 100 monkeys sitting in a room with a keyboard. Okay? And the keyboard has numbers from 1 to 100 on it. And each monkey hits the keyboard once for a banana. Okay? No matter what key they hit, they get a banana. So at random, we should have no way of predicting what number is going to come up. And the grades, or the numbers, should follow some kind of statistical curve. We would not expect all the numbers to be in one area. They should be evenly distributed. Okay. So now the question is, how do I produce random numbers? Well, I could actually flip a coin. Because that, if it's a totally honest coin, that no way of predicting what it's going to be, and it will give you the statistics of a coin. But clearly a computer can't do that. So the question is, how does one create random numbers? And the answer is that you can't. Because if I tell you how to create a random number, I've already violated the very first rule of random numbers. Because you now know how to create the next number. Does everyone see the problem? You can't create random numbers, because then they're not random. The minute I tell you how to do it, I violate the first rule, which will enable you to cheat if it was a game. So, there are two approaches. One approach is to use some physical phenomena. For example, suppose I had a container and I had some radioactive substance in that container. And next to that container I had a Geiger counter. And the Geiger counter detects every time an atom disintegrates, which is purely at random. So I hook that up to a computer, and I use the randomness of the disintegration to pick a number, and then, since you have no way ahead of time predicting which atom is going to disintegrate, that's one way. Another way, take a radio, an ordinary AM or FM radio, and what happens when you go in between stations? You hear static, what's called random noise. Okay, it's called random noise because that's what it is. It's not like voice that has certain shapes and so on. It's random. What it comes from, basically, is the fact that the Earth is surrounded by the Van Allen belts, which have radiation in them, and there are cosmic rays that are hitting the Earth and going through your body at all times, and there's solar wind particles that are hitting, and all of that is picked up by the radio's antenna, and you get... And since that's totally random, let's hook that up to a computer and do that. Of course, that's also impractical in most cases. So therefore, it turns out that I can't physically produce random numbers unless I relate to some physical phenomenon, like flipping coins or flipping dice. What I need to do, however, is something else. What I could do, however, is create a formula to produce make-believe random numbers. Now, because it's a formula to produce make-believe random numbers, right away, they're not really 100% random. So instead of calling them random numbers, we will call them now pseudo-random numbers. Pseudo meaning make-believe, fake random numbers. Because it violates the first rule of random numbers, because you know now how to produce the next random number. On the other hand, I'll create a formula that produces numbers, even though I can predict what the next number is going to be, it'll produce numbers that follow the statistics. So for example, if I want a random number generator set to do a coin, I'll create a formula, although if you follow the formula by hand, you'll be able to predict whether it's going to be heads or tails, but it will produce 50% heads and 50% tails as I do it many, many times. Same thing, I'll have a formula for random numbers for dice. Although it's a formula and I can predict what the next one is going to be, because if I don't tell you what it's going to be, then you can't cheat. But it could predict. But it'll give you 1/6 of the times it'll give you a 1, 1/6 of the time it'll give you 2, and so on and so forth. Or in general, I will create a formula that produces a number between 1 and some very large number, evenly distributed. Now, let's think about that for a moment. If you have a formula that produces random numbers, that means every time I use the formula, it'll give me the same set of random numbers. They'll be at random, in other words, they'll follow the statistics, but I can mark down, oh, okay, the first one will always be a 0, the next one will always be a 0, the next one will always be a 1, then 2 more zeros. Every time I use the formula, you'll get the same results. So that doesn't help us in a game, because a game gets boring very quickly if you can predict what the numbers are going to be. So what we do is, we do something a little more complicated. Let's assume we have some function, f, which produces random numbers according to some formula, which I'm not telling you what it is right now. Let's provide this function a value to get it started. We call that the seed. We give it a first number. Now, every time you use the first number, you will get the same set of numbers. Because it's a formula. Formulas are deterministic. You put a number into a formula, into a function, out comes a number. So if I start out with one number, each time I call this function, it's going to give me another number, but they're going to be in a certain sequence. But what I'll do is, I'll ask a third party, somebody else, to guess that, not that the person who's playing the game, I'll ask someone else to choose a number from 1 to a million. Now, there's no way that third party is going to talk to you, so they'll choose a different number to get this started each and every time. By choosing a different number each start each time, the sequence of numbers will be the same. Now, I don't have a third party here because the computer is sitting here and my third party is another room. But the computer has a clock inside, doesn't it? And the clock ticks. You know, it's now 9:49 and 30 seconds, 9:49 and 31 seconds. You're never going to be sitting in front of the computer and playing the game at exactly the same instant in time. So what I do is I tell the computer, before it starts generating random numbers, look at your clock. See what time it is right now. Use that number, whatever it happens to be, to start off your random number generator. So therefore, that's my third party providing essentially a random seed, since it's random when you start playing the game. That random seed fed into our pseudo-random number generator then produces a bunch of numbers that mimic what real random numbers are. Now, why is this so important? Actually, this is a very big mathematical field, the generation of random numbers, and there are papers being produced on this all the time. Why is this important? Well, first of all, game playing, if nothing else, is an important topic, makes a lot of money. So to have a game that's truly at random, when you play a game like Doom and shoot up monsters, you want the monsters to pop out from different places each time. You don't always want to learn that the monster always comes from this side, always from this room, always after you do this, because then you're prepared to blow the monster's head off each time. Any real game has to be really have a lot of random elements in it to give you the excitement of wanting to play it again. But there are many, many real applications of random numbers. I'm going to give you two such examples from mathematics. First of all, okay, how many of you have had calculus already? Okay, if not, we'll just talk about it. You've got some curve. And there's a very interesting question, how does one find what's called the area under the curve? How does one find... This is a practical problem. Suppose you have a room, you're living in a mansion, and the room, like this room, is not rectangular. And you go to the store and you want to buy carpet. And you want to buy the minimum amount of carpet you need, because carpet is very expensive if you live in a mansion, that will cover the floor. You don't want to buy any more or less carpet than you need. That is, if that's the floor plan of my house, that is the problem of finding the area under a curve. If I describe the shape of this room algebraically, and then I say, what's the area under the curve, which is exactly the area of the floor. So how does one do it? So mathematically, one says, if this is the x-axis, and this is what's called this point A, and this is point B, and this curve is described by the function f of x, we say that we want to find A, B, of f of x dx. That's the mathematical way of saying, in English, find the area under a curve. Okay, but that didn't tell me how to find it. So, if that's a function that I can algebraically manipulate, there are methods that you learn in Calc 1 and Calc 2 on how to mathematically, something called division, integration by parts. There's ways of doing the algebra that gives you an answer. Not learn that. This is not important. The problem is that there are many, many, many functions for which you can't solve them that way. So we need estimation ways of estimating. And you probably learned some of those estimation ways. One easy way of doing it is very simple. Draw it on a piece of paper. Take a scissors and cut it out in the shape. Put it on a scale, one side of a scale, and then take little square pieces of paper and put them on the other side of the scale. And keep on putting little square pieces of paper on the other side of the scale until both sides of paper weighs the same. Now you know the area of the curve because the square pieces, you can easily do length times width. And if it weighs the same, you found the area of the curve. It's sort of a non-mathematical way of doing it, but that will work. Although it's sort of hard to do it if I need a shape of a curve that's this big as this room. But theoretically, I can do it that way. Right? Does that make sense to people? Okay. Another method that you may have learned is to divide this into rectangles. And to do something like this. Okay. Since these are rectangles, if I measure this and I measure this, now of course, Here I cut out a little bit of what should have been in the curve. Here I've included some stuff that shouldn't be, but hopefully they'll balance each other out. And since I now have little rectangles, I measure from here to here, which is just the y-axis, the x-axis, and I measure from here to here, which is just the x-axis, this times this gives me the area of this rectangle, and so on and so forth, and that will give me the area under a curve. Right? Is this familiar? You've seen this, maybe? And one says that, clearly, the smaller you make the curves, the intervals, the more accurate it gets, because less pieces will be sticking out or below. And then there's a method that says, you know what, instead of using rectangles, why don't we create trapezoids? Because trapezoids will more than likely include more of the curve than the rectangles do. Okay? And that's called the trapezoid method. So that's another method. Does that sound familiar? Okay. But here's a method I'm sure doesn't sound familiar. You go to a bar. You put this on the wall. You line up a bunch of people and tell them to throw darts at that thing. Now, since they're all drunk, they're throwing the darts purely at random. Right? If they throw the darts purely at random, the number of darts that hits under the curve and the number of darts that hit outside of the curve should be proportional to the area under the curve and the area above the curve. Right? Look, the bigger the target, if you're throwing darts, the bigger the target, the more you're going to accidentally get inside the target. And the fewer you'll get outside the target. The smaller a target, the less you are accidentally going to manage to hit the target, and the more you're going to hit outside. So the number of darts that hit under the target, if it's purely random, they're really drunk. If they can aim, then they're aiming. That's no good. I need to blindfold them, make them drunk, and let them just throw darts purely at random. And then I count how many darts hit underneath, and how many hit outside, and the relative area will be exactly the same as the relative number of darts that hit underneath and hit inside. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, of course, if I only threw 5 darts, that's not going to tell me. But if I threw 1,000,000 darts, remember the more, as n goes to infinity, if I threw 1,000,000 darts, then it's going to get very close to the actual area. That method of mathematics, it's an entire branch of mathematics, is called Monte Carlo methods. And it's a very, very powerful technique. Now, obviously, we can't go to the bar, and we can't hire 1,000,000 drunk people to throw darts. But we can hire a computer and tell a computer to throw virtual darts at this, and then we can count how many darts hit under the curve, how many darts hit above the curve. The ratio to the two of them is going to be the area under the curve. Make sense? Give you another example. How does one calculate the value of pi? Can you calculate? Is there a formula for calculating the value of pi? No, because 22 over 7 is just an estimation. Okay, pi goes on and on and on, and there's no formula that predicts what the next how the next digit is going to be. But how about the following trick? I draw a rectangle and I draw a circle. Okay? Now, this is the radius, and you know that the area of a circle is equal to pi r squared. Correct? Now, I can know how big of a square I have. So I can easily calculate the area of the square. Okay? I can't so easily calculate the area of the circle, because that's a curve. Again, same idea. So again, I go to the bar and I make this a bullseye. And we start throwing darts. Now, the area, if I figure out which darts hit here in the circle and how many hit outside the circle, that will give me the ratio of the area of the circle versus the area of the square. Yes? Well, I'm using darts figuratively. If you threw darts completely at random, okay, you cover your eyes, you weren't looking, and you just threw a dart, where it hit would be random. Therefore, you'd expect to find in this picture more dots in the circle and fewer dots in the corners of the rectangle.
So we're given a score.
Well, obviously, we're not letting the dots go out the door. But we're saying throw dots, or we tell the computer to choose a number, which is another way of saying it, which represents a coordinate within that rectangle. Choose that coordinate at random, which essentially means throwing a dart at random. Once you choose coordinates at random, or throw dots at random, the number of dots that hit inside the circle is going to be proportional to the number of dots that are in the circle versus the number of dots that are in the square, depending on this area of the circle versus the square. Okay? Since I can easily compute the area of the square, if you have a proportion equals to a constant, to a number, then if you know one of them, you know the other. So now I know the area of the circle. If I know the area of the circle, and I know the radius, because I drew the square, it's the unit square, then I can calculate what pi is. Again, if I only threw 5 dots, not very good. But if I threw 100,000 dots at this, you would actually get, and I sometimes give this as an assignment. I ask the students, how many dots would you need before you get a good answer? At about 1,000 dots, you're already at 3.14. When you're up to about 1,000,000 dots, you get to 3.1415. 10 million dots, 3.14159, whatever. In other words, the more dots you throw, the more precise you will know the area of the circle. The more precise you know the area of the circle, the more precise you can calculate area equals pi r squared and find out what pi is. And this is a very... Now, you're not going to throw dots by hand, but a computer can generate millions of numbers per second, and therefore we can do this calculation very, very quickly. So it's a very practical... Monte Carlo methods are a very practical way of doing calculations that would be very, very tedious if done by hand. So statistics and Monte Carlo methods are extremely important in computer science and in science in general. If you're a chemist, let's say, you're studying chemistry, we know the property of a single atom. We study atoms very, very well. What happens when you take trillions and trillions of atoms and put them into a cup? Then they begin to interact with each other. But they, each one can do things at random. It's very hard to follow each atom and predict what the bulk material does. But if we use Monte Carlo methods, and we can assign random behavior to each of the different atoms, we can actually predict. For example, they can predict. We know properties of water, water molecules. What are the properties of water in a cup? Why does water freeze and get bigger rather than get smaller, as most things do when they freeze? Why does water have certain properties? Why can bugs walk across water? Things of that type can be predicted from knowing individual molecular properties and then extending that at random using these type of formulas to try that, to do it random millions and millions and millions of times, predict bulk properties. So there's a very, very useful process. Be that as it may, then, what we need for our program is a way of producing a pseudo-random number. I can't give you a method of producing a real random number, because then it wouldn't be random if I told you it. But if there's a function that produces numbers that behave similarly to what you expect out of random numbers, it will take. It's good enough. Now, of course, the trick is to find a good function. And that's a lot of mathematical research goes on. The particular function that C++ uses is not such a good function. But for our dice playing, it's more than enough. Even if we're playing sophisticated games, it's more than enough. But for true mathematics, it doesn't work 100% the way it should. We really need to get better and better methods. So let's see how we do that. So getting back to our program. The computer said call it. You are going to, in a moment, say heads or tails. Meanwhile, I'm going to call a function called toss. And what toss has to do, as you said, told me before, toss has to give me back a 0 or a 1 at random. A 0, 1 at random. How does one do that? So let's look at the toss function. It's actually quite simple. There is a function in this library called rand, R-A-N-D, open, close. And the rand function's job is to produce a random number between 0 and a very large number. Whatever that very large number is not important to us. So when every time you call the function, just like every time you call a square root function, it gives you back the square root of a number. Every time you call the rand function, it goes ahead and gives you back a pseudo-random number between 0 and some very large number. But that's not what I want. I want not any number at random. I want the number 0 at 1. So how does one convert any number into a 0 or a 1? Think for a moment. How do you convert any number into either a 0 or a 1? No, you don't multiply it by 0 because that will turn it any number into 0. That's all you'll get. How do we convert any number to 0 or 1? No, Boolean is 0 or 1, but how do we... If I give you the number 77, how do I turn it into a 0 or 1? Well, think about it for a minute. Any number in the world, whatever you give me, is either odd or even. Is that correct? What does that mean? If it's even, it means when you divide it by 2, the remainder is 0. And if it's an odd number and you divide it by 2, the remainder is going to be 1. Right? So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to call the random function. Well, this now is going to be any number at random. I'm going to mod it by 2. The result is at random a 0 or a 1. And I send that back. I return that. So there, I've solved the problem of how a computer can toss a coin. What happens if you wanted to simulate not heads or tails, think of this for a moment, but you wanted to simulate the rolling of a dice? Close. Let's think for a moment. If you take any number and you divide it by 6, what could the remainders possibly be? Or 0. Can't be 6. If you divide something by 6, remainder can't be 6. But the remainder could be 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, right? So if you needed to get a random number from 1 to 6, you would simply say x is assigned the value of rand mod 6 plus 1. Remember, this has higher precedence, right? Since this is going to be a number between 0 and 5, that's all it possibly could be, then that plus the 1 must be a random number between 1 and 6. Suppose you were playing a game and you wanted the computer to choose a number from 1 to 10 at random. How do you do that? Rand mod 10 plus 1. That would be a random number from 1 to 10. So once we assume we have this function rand that gets us any random number, we can then use formulas of this type to give us, in this case, a 0 or a 1. And that's what we do. So now returning back. So let's follow our program. The idea again, for those who came in late or have just forgotten where we've been since we've been doing this the whole day, the idea is to have the computer simulate the game of heads or tails. So, this is the wrong place. We're not in this function. We are in the play function. Right, there we are. First, we're going to call it, print that message. The computer will now call the function toss that we just looked at. The function toss is going to give me back at random the number 0 or 1, right? It's going to put that into the variable called coin. So far, so good? Now we want to compare it with what you said. This is what the computer said. So we call a function called getCallFromUser. Now look at that function in a moment. But if getCallFromUser is the same as the coin that the computer tossed, then what have you done? You've won. So I'll say plus plus win, and report a win with that coin. If they don't match, then you have lost, and I will say plus plus lose, report a loss coin with the coin. And that's the game. And then I do that over as many times as you wanted to do it over, 10 times. And when that's finished, we're out of this loop, and then we simply have to print a final report. So all I need to show you now is those two functions, getCallFromUser and print the final report, which are really very simple. getCallFromUser, okay, before I reveal what getCallFromUser does, what do we want getCall? Tell me what we want getCallFromUser to do. Well, we already asked, we already said call it. We want to just get the, say what you were going to say, keep us saying. Not ask the user, but get from the user and more precisely in this program, the 0 or 1, right? And what do we want to make sure? That it's not like he was trying to cheat and putting in a 3 or a 5, right? We want to make sure that the only thing that is valid is a 0 or a 1, our robust program, which we did last time. So let's now look at getCallFromUser. Very simple. See in the guess, the number that you answered. While guess is not equal to 0 and guess not equal to 1, do that over and over and over again until he stops putting in 3s and 5s and 4s and 2s, until eventually he gets tired and puts in a 0 or a 1. In which case, we drop out of the loop and we return that number. So here is the function that guarantees that the only acceptable answer will be a 0 or a 1. And then that goes back to the play function, which compares it with what the coin that the computer tossed, and either says you won or you lost. So let's look at those functions. Report a win. If coin equals equals 0, I have heads, you win. If the coin that matched was a tails, I have tails, you win. Report a loss is exactly the same. But this time, the coin didn't match. So I say, I have a heads, you lost. I have a tails, you lost. Depending which one it was that the computer had, which is not the one you had. And finally, after playing the game multiple times, we produce our final report. The final report has to know how many games were won, how many games were lost, total number of games, and it prints out this message. So let's play the game again, just to remind us how this works. Okay. First, it prints out our instructions. Remember, that was the first thing we did. The main simply says, how many times do you want to play? We put in a number like, I'll put in 4 times we want to play. It takes the number 4, sends it to the play function. The play function has a loop that will do it 4 times. What will it do 4 times? First, it will say, call it. I mean, now it's also going and it's tossing the coin and getting back a heads or a tails. I'm putting in a tails. It matches it with what it has and says, you won. Comes back the loop again. Call it again. I put in a tails again. Whoops. It says, I have tails, you win. Okay, call it. I have heads, you lose. Okay, remember, statistics doesn't mean to say that each time you flip, it's going to be, but it's 50%, 50%. Okay. Call it again. This time I decide to cheat. I put in a 5. It says, 0 for heads, 1 for tails. I try again. Try 4. No good. Finally, I put in a 1 or a 0. It says, I have heads, you lose. Number of games you won was 2. Number of games you lost is 2. Total number of games is 4. Okay, of course, I should never play an even number of games, because that could mean there's a tie. But if there's an odd number of games, they'll never be. That's why committees should never have even number of members, so that when they vote, there's never a tie. Okay? Now, this is probably the longest program that we've looked at. But the idea is, by using functions and breaking down a tremendously complicated task into smaller and smaller pieces, it makes the program completely understandable. You should take this 2 sheets home and figure out how, make sure that you understand how it works. Are there any questions? Okay. Let's continue to study functions a bit, especially since the assignment that you're now going to be doing, or you're working on now, involves the use of functions. So we need to learn a lot about functions in order for you to successfully do the assignment. I need to define some terminology for you. The first terminology we're going to talk about is called the scope of variables. Now, every variable has a name, just like every person sitting in this class has a name. When you're in this room, I can call you. I can refer to you. I can talk to you. When you walk out the door, I can't talk to you anymore. It doesn't mean you've gone out of existence. It doesn't mean that you've disappeared. It doesn't mean that when you come back into the room, you're born from fresh. It just means that when you're in this room, I can talk to you. When you are in another room, I can't talk to you. Okay? That's what scope tells me. The scope of a variable tells me when you can refer to a variable. It doesn't say when the variable comes into existence, when it goes out of existence, simply when you could be referred to. Now let's say you walked from this room to the next door room. If I'm in this room, I can talk to you. But I can't talk to you if I'm in this room and you're in the other room. Similarly, if you are in the other room and I'm there, I can talk to you. But then I can't talk to you when you are in this room. That's the definition of a local variable. And I'll give you the rules for local variables. Here's the definition. A local variable is a variable that is defined within a function or as its parameter. Local variables have no relationship to any other variable, even with the same name. If I have function A, let's call it, and in here I say int x, and then I have another function, function B, let's call it, and in here I have int x, this x and that x have nothing to do with each other. Saying x is assigned the value of 5 here does not change the x here that I say maybe has the value 6. When you trace this program, you make separate boxes, bubbles for x here, and separate bubbles for x there. Okay? X is a local variable. Similarly, if I had function C, and in this one there was a parameter, float x, and I said x here is assigned the value of 17, this x has nothing to do with that x or that x, because it's a parameter of a function, it's a local variable, it has no relationship to any other variable that has the same name. That concept clear? The opposite of a local variable is a global variable. Suppose you carried a walkie-talkie, and wherever you went, I could talk to you. Then I could, every time I tell you to do something or give you a value, you'll get that value no matter where you are. So a global variable is any variable that is declared outside of a function, and it is known by all functions that follow it. Let's say these were in my program in order. First you typed in function A, then you typed in function B, then you typed in function C. Suppose before function A, before it, you said int z. And you then said, let's initialize. Int z is assigned a value of 15. And then in here, you say c out z. It will print the 15, even though z is not in that function, because z is global. Now, let's get a little complicated. Suppose in here I say int z, and I say z is the value of 22. And I say c out z. What will be printed by function b? 22. Let's say I now go to function c and say c out z. What will be printed? 15. Because it was declared in this function, is the private z. It belongs only to this function. But this z is the global z. So any function that follows it, unless it makes a new local variable, therefore this z is that z, this z is this z, and this z is the global one, the one on the outside. Everyone got that? Okay. That's the concept of scope of variables. Now there's another concept. The next question comes, this is a slightly different question. When do you come into existence, and when do you go out of existence? Now a human being goes into existence when you're born, and you go out of existence when you die. So let's take the following example. You were born some 20 years ago, so you now exist. You came into this room, and I say to you, you have the value of 100. You go to another room. Did you die? I hope not. But can I talk to you? No, because your scope is local. Then you come back to this room and say, what was the valid number I told you? You're 100. Okay? See the difference between local and global? Between scope and allocation of storage? Allocation of storage tells you when the variable comes into existence. Scope doesn't say when you were born or when you died. It just tells me when I can refer to you. One moment. We'll have to take this a little bit further, this analogy. Let's say, however, the situation was different. Every time you walked through this door, you were born again with no previous memory. So if I told, and every time you walked out this door, as far as I'm concerned, you're dead. So if I tell you, you have a value of 200, and you walk out this door, poof, you disappeared. The next day you come back to class, freshly born. And I ask you, what was your value? You say, huh? Okay? So, allocation of storage tells us when variables come in and out of existence. Scope of variables tells me when I can refer to them. Now, there are several different rules for allocation of storage. Let me just give you two of them now, one of which we've been using all along without knowing it. And the other one, which we'll learn about in about a week or two. Auto and static. Every variable up until now, in other words, its default, without having said anything special about it, has the property of what we call automatic storage class, or automatic allocation of storage. And what that means is like the second example I gave you. Every time you come in to a function, the variables are created from scratch, brand new variables. And every time the function is left, all the variables are deallocated. That means their storage is given back. They go poof, they turn into nothing. And the next time they come back, the next time we come back to the function, the variable is brand new. So it has no way of knowing what was in it beforehand. Each time you come into a function, the variables are recreated from scratch. So, suppose I had this statement, X equals 6 here. The next time I come into the function up here, since I still haven't said X equals 6, it has no idea what X is, because X is a brand new variable with no memory. That's called automatic storage. And all variables that we've had so far have no memory of themselves the next time you come back. That's why you can't put a counter inside a function. Because each time you come back to the function, the counter starts out all over again at 0. Right? Now there's another type of variable, which we haven't yet learned about, called a static variable. And just so you have it in your notes, I'll tell you now that a static variable is created, or we say is allocated, the first time you hit the function. But it remains in effect until the program is over completely. Now that doesn't mean that I can refer to it. Look, as far as I'm concerned, you were born the first time you walked into this room. I don't know you from before this room. So as far as I'm concerned, you're brand new as far as the minute you walk through this door. I teach you stuff. And when you go home, I can't talk to you anymore. But when you come back, I expect you to still know everything I taught you. So you see, you have static storage allocation. You came into existence when the program began. I guess when you're born, but as far as I'm concerned, when this class began. And you remain in effect alive for a long time to come. But you're still a local variable. Even though you're alive and you have memory of each time you come back to the classroom, but when you're outside this room, I can't talk to you. Because you're a local variable with static allocation. Does that make sense? Does that analogy make sense to everyone? Okay. So that is where I want to leave you today. And next class, on Monday, we'll start looking at functions and how these rules affect them in practice.